Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
There is a Star Wars reference in the script. Was that in it before your participation, or was that added as a wink afterwards?
Nah, it was always in it. It was always in it. And I was like, is that like, should I have a whatever. It's cool. And then it just stayed in. But people liked it in the festivals. I was like, wow, okay, cool. Yeah, they like a little Star Wars reference over there. It's kind of cool.
Hello, 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 and welcome to another episode of Push the Envelope. I'm the AV Club's editor-in-chief, Patrick Gomez, and being that this is Thanksgiving, we're doing things a little different this week. Instead of a staff chat to kick things off, we've doubled your pleasure and doubled your fun, hopefully, with two interviews. Fresh off of speaking to his The Night Of co-star John Turturro on last week's episode, today we're going to be hearing from Sound of Metal star Riz Ahmed. And then we'll chat with Star Wars alum John Boyega, who stars in the Steve McQueen film anthology series Small Axe's upcoming installment, Red, White, and Blue. Joining me now is the AV Club's executive producer of audio and video initiatives, Mara Eakin. Thanks for joining, Mara. So you recently got to speak with Riz and check out his new film, Sound of Metal, right?
Yes, and I really loved Sound of Metal, and I really loved talking to Riz.
It's fantastic. Well, so tell us a little bit about what Sound of Metal is before we hear your discussion with him.
So Sound of Metal is sort of billed as heavy metal drummer loses his sense of hearing and is thrown into this free fall where he doesn't know who he is. But I mean, in reality, like, the hearing loss is such a huge part of the movie, and it's such a huge, the sound design is all affected by it. You're hearing what he's hearing. You're hearing it fade in and out. And also you're sort of talking about identity, which is honestly something that Riz and I talked about related to COVID as well. Like, when things are taken away from you, in this case, his hearing, his livelihood, his girlfriend, you realize who you've really become and like who you actually really are as a person. And or you have to figure that out. And that's what we talked about. And I think it's a really amazing movie. And I think there's a lot of Oscar buzz around him. And I think it's well deserved.
Well, perfect. Well, let's get right to it. Here is Mara's chat with Riz Ahmed.
The movie is about hearing loss, but it's also sort of about Ruben's sudden loss of like identity. Everything he thinks he is, like a drummer, a boyfriend, a musician, or whatever, is taken away from him almost overnight. Who do you think that Ruben really is, like, having spent some time with him as a character?
You know, that's such a great question, because I don't know if we ever arrive at a definitive answer of who we really are, but I think we take steps closer and closer to stripping away the external things that we think define us, you know, or at least stripping away our attachment to them. And in that way, you know, look, Ruben thinks, as you said, I'm this kind of guy. I'm in a relationship. I live in a camp, in a mobile home, and I play the drums. That's me. I'm not a deaf person living in a sober house that's single. That's the opposite of who I am. And yet, over the course of going through that journey, he arguably gets more in touch with who he is. And sometimes the things that we cling onto to give us an identity are actually getting in the way of who we really are. You know, I think that there's a lot of scars, a lot of wounds in Ruben that he's been papering over with the band-aids of a relationship and an obsessive focus on drumming, just as he had an obsessive kind of, you know, drug addiction in the past. And I think that it's actually staying busy and doing and having purpose is just another way of running away from himself. So it's actually sitting in the silence, facing the void where you face yourself. And I'm not sure if he could put into words or I can put into words who he really is, but I like to think that at our core, we're all pretty much the same, you know, underneath it all, there's a core of humanity that we all share.
It's interesting because
he went through something pretty singular here, but like in my mind, there's some parallel with what's happened to a lot of people with COVID in the sense that like, oh, yeah. I used to hang out with my friends. My job is this, that's me. Like, and how that all got taken away from a lot of people really fast. And now people are trying to kind of figure out what, who they are and what they do.
Yes, yes, 100%. I was thinking that myself, you know, it's like, it's kind of wild in a way, but I think people will be able to relate to that journey of like the things I thought defined me, the things I felt gave me worth, be, you know, been stripped away. Now who am I? And, you know, that's really challenging and that's really tragic. And there's real loss that comes in that kind of like change of circumstance. There can also be a gift hidden inside it if we are able to embrace it and move past those challenges. You know, it's so hard for people who've lost their living, lost loved ones. I don't mean to suggest that like, oh, great, this is like an enforced spirituality retreat for everyone. No, like COVID is real and it's, you know, it's destroyed families, communities and livelihoods. I guess on a macro level as a society, I hope it's an opportunity for us all to think about, all right, what are we doing? What really matters? And that's what happens when you face a crisis. That's what happens in times of uncertainty. You're forced to reassess what you're doing with your life. And I hope that that's partly what, you know, that's certainly something Ruben's forced to do. I hope that's what society does. And I hope in a small way that people who watch this film also walk away asking some questions about, huh, what really mattered to me if it all changed, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think like the holidays, that's like a whole can of worms, but something that really staggered me watching this movie in relation to hearing loss was the cochlear implant, like hearing what it actually sounds like to hear from that. I thought was very, you know, you see these videos of like babies hearing their moms and you just imagine they're hearing a certain way. And that's not really how people are hearing. What in terms of hearing loss, like was really staggering to you? Like I'm imagining you learned a lot.
I did learn a lot. You know, I'm grateful to everyone who taught me a lot. I remember sitting next to someone on a plane with a cochlear implant who just got into a 2-hour conversation with him about it. And he told me about getting his implant was the worst day of his life because of what he was expecting. And we had, I remember speaking to other people who were like, this was the best day of my life. There is no one deaf experience. There's no one deaf community. I guess I just had to try and hone in on, you know, some of the research and some of the stories and some of the experiences that I was able to immerse myself in, and then just try and be honest about where Ruben's head would be at with all of this stuff. You know, is someone who's always looking for a quick fix, looking for more, looking to do. I'm not sure that it would be enough for him, you know, that implant. And for many people it works, and for many people it doesn't. You know, it's a very controversial issue within the deaf community. But I think it was just more than anything for me, if I'm honest, it was just a tremendous learning experience, you know, learning about the richness and expansiveness and variety of this culture that has so much to offer us in the hearing community, if only we would stop living in such a segregated way with deaf people.
Yeah, even in the film, like where they live is like way out on the sticks, you know, like there's no interaction. There's very little interaction there between the deaf community and the hearing community, I guess. You mentioned that Ruben is like always humming, doing, working. Do you have that quality? Like, are you always busy, busy? And then did this movie make you slow down at all?
You know, certainly. It's something that really drew me to the character. I was like, I recognize this dude. He like defines himself for his work and he's always on the go. And I've also experienced those moments of like being forced to stop for various reasons, personal reasons, health reasons, financial reasons, thinking, can I continue doing the thing I love? You know, and those moments were terrifying because they make you think, well, then who am I? And I was like, I recognize that feeling and I want to go deeper into it. At the end of this, I guess what of the process of making this film, something that I feel now is, you know, I'm trying to kind of realize that sometimes constantly running towards a goal is just a way of running away from yourself, you know? And I guess what I'm trying to do a bit more is stay out of goal-oriented doing. You know, this performance has to be like this. I want this song to perform like that. And kind of thinking more about like, how can I tap into where I'm at right now and just share a bit of that kind of a bit more connected doing rather than escapist doing. It's not always easy and some days are better than others, but I feel like when I do manage to tap into that, things are just better.
speaking of songs, you know, I guess I was wondering about Black Gammon's influences. I was like, are they a metal band? Are they a noise band? Is it like the Locust or Lightning Bolt or whatever? Did they give you sort of like a playlist of like, here's the kind of stuff that Black Gammon would be into?
We kind of immersed ourselves a little bit in that scene. So Olivia was mentored by Pharmacon, who's an amazing artist, the kind of noise artist. I was mentored by Sean, the drummer from Surfboard, which is a punk band. I interviewed a bunch of other kind of metal bands and experimental noise bands and hung out with them. You know, Kill Altars is a band that I was kind of very much into. I thought they were a cool template for us. But Surfboard and Pharmacon, somewhere where those two meet, was kind of like where our band existed. And yeah, it was similar to like being immersed into the deaf community, being immersed into that community, which one I hadn't been into, was such a gift, you know, just meeting those incredibly creative, sensitive souls. And again, like, you know, the idea of tribe can separate us so much from people. I always thought, you know, I'm like a person of color from like, you know, a city setting in London who raps, and like, I didn't know anything about this experience of like, you know, noise bands and punk, and I just hadn't been around that. And to connect with people in that scene was just joyous. And again, just teaching me the lesson that Ruben learns, that I think a lot of us need to learn right now, is like, we think we're all so different and we're trapped up in our identities and our identity politics, and it's kind of bullshit, you know? We're the same.
It's really interesting to hear your discussion, Mara, with him about identity and how much he feels that like the deaf community isn't a monolith too. I thought that was a really interesting element of your discussion, and kind of how he had to just latch on to the bits of it that he felt identified with the character, because you can't really take on a community like the deaf community as though it's all the same.
Yeah, I mean, I think that makes sense. I mean, you'd say that about the gay community, any sort of like marginalized, you know, community. Mm-hmm. So I think that he learned that very smartly and approached that very smartly. Having so many deaf actors in the movie, I think probably helped a lot too.
Oh, of course. I mean, you know, making sure that there's not just one representative of any sort of community is important. And actually, that's a little bit of what I spoke to with John Boyega for his new Small Axe installment, Red, White, and Blue. In that, he actually stars as the real-life trailblazer Leroy Logan, who became one of the first people of color to join London's police force in the 1980s. And, you know, this Small Axe is a whole anthology film series from Steve McQueen speaking to the kind of Black Caribbean experience in London throughout the UK's history. And it's super interesting. And so we chatted all about that, as well as how the piece kind of aligns with John's real life activism. You know, we've seen him make headlines regarding how he feels the Star Wars franchise dealt with their characters of color in this most recent trilogy, as well as his voice was well heard during all the protests this past summer with the Black Lives Matter movement. So this was a piece that was really, really close to his heart, and gave him a great opportunity to move on past the Star Wars trilogy. But still, if we get to it a little bit, I don't want to spoil it for anyone, but there's a little bit of a Star Wars wink in the film, and we talk a little bit about that and how that came to be. So without further ado, here is my chat with John Boyega.
Thanks so much for joining us, John. I'm still getting a little used to doing these remotely. I'd love to be able to do these in person. How has this adjustment been for you? And I'm sure you had a very whirlwind end of 2019 to head right into the pandemic with everything shut down. What's that experience been like for you this year?
Well, it's been a very huge transition, as it's been for a lot of people. I think being at home and having to quarantine for so long and then making these adjustments has been so mad. It's been highs, it's been lows, but, you know, I can't complain in comparison, you know. I'm good, but it's just about, you know, the mystery of what's next. And I just wonder what else could this year possibly dish us. So it's been all right, but we're just getting through it.
Yeah. Well, now of course you're promoting Small Axe, which you've got coming up. And John, you would not be familiar with this, but subscribers to the podcast would know that we actually had our film reviewer, A.A. Dowd, come on and discuss his five favorite projects that he saw at the New York Film Festival recently. And Small Axe was among those. So we're super excited that more people are going to be able to see it. And I could describe what Small Axe is, but I'm going to punt that over to you, John, to kind of give us a synopsis of what these five episodes of this anthology are about.
Yeah, I mean, I see them as five films just because of the quality and what Steve has done with this. But essentially, it's five films that goes into the experiences of Black Caribbean people in the UK through various obstacles and challenges in a London and in a Britain that's not necessarily ready for their kind of representation. There's love in there. There's an exploration of social divide, family dynamics change. In my specific film, Red, White and Blue, I play Leroy Logan, who is a police scientist, turned police officer, who wants to go into an institution and obviously change it from the inside. And that stands as one of the biggest challenges of his life. And Small Axe, really, in its strange, unique format, created by Steve McQueen, joins all these different stories together to give us just a really, really good dynamic insight into, you know, British history.
And I know Steve McQueen first announced the project back in 2014, but we didn't get your casting announcement until last year in 2019. At what point did you become a part of the project? Did you become aware of the project? Did it become something you wanted to do?
Literally, as soon as they were done, I think they approached me, you know, being a few months out of shooting, and they were ready to go. And that's the first time I'm hearing. I didn't know. I have no idea that Steve mentioned it in 2014. But when Steve approached me, I had just done with the franchise. So I was like, this is perfect. You know, I've been looking for something to do. I'm at the crossroads now when it's kind of like, what's next? And the healthiest thing for me to do is definitely to be a part of something and partner up with somebody that I definitely creatively trust. And so it was definitely a no-brainer for me.
You are somebody, speaking your character, you said, tries to enter something and change something from the inside. You yourself have been very outspoken in terms of fighting for racial equality and against injustice all over the globe. How much of that played into your desire to be a part of this project specifically? And do you feel like you learned as an advocate and voice, do you feel like you learned anything by doing this?
I think that this was a story for me that I wanted to see told. Like I wanted to be a part of I wanted to be the artist who presented you this story. I wanted to play the guy that you as an audience have to understand and follow. And for me, because this was done, you know, before the protests or before any of the stuff that's gone down, before we went to lockdown, you know, it was a time for us to reflect on the conversations that were bubbling and issues that were still, you know, apparent. And the fact that whenever you bring out these type of films, it always seems to be timeless. You know, and having to deal with that reality. So it was an interesting process with all of it.
Tell the listeners a little bit more about Logan and Red, White, and Blue and kind of the journey that he goes on.
Yeah, you know, Leroy Logan starts off as a scientist, baby on the way, very full family, a father that loves him, mother that cherishes him, and a great educator, somebody that is prominent in his field and is doing quite well. And because of the changes in his community, he decides that he's of better use by fighting for representation within the police force. And he puts himself in that position, first off, as his strategy. He joins and then is obviously met with institutional racism and has to navigate this very, very toxic space. And this film just really dwells into the challenges of that and the day-to-day conflicts that come with this. You know, being a Black man joining the Met at the time, the Met didn't necessarily have the greatest race relations with their Black civilians. You were seen as a traitor or a Judas, and you can see in the scenes in the film that he's called this several different times. And those conflicts are also explored in this as well. Finally, we don't see the officers as kind of like ghoulish bodies in uniforms with no identity. We go into one officer's strategy to try and change things, and we try and experience his frustrations.
There's a moment in which a character tells your character, you know, this isn't like the States where they have a bunch of Black officers already. And it's just interesting as an American watching this project for them to say like, hey, like at least from the outside, it looks like they've got this going on a little bit better over there at the time.
Right, right. Yeah, it's interesting to know that there was their perspective as well, especially when talking to Leroy, you know, just to see from looking from the outside in, it was like, yo, we need that representation. As he says to his mate, is just like, you know, if I was in the police force, do you believe I'd drape you up? Do you think I'd mess you up if I was there? And to see that and to understand that Leroy found that to be a very, very serious issue that could possibly lead to more discrimination, for him to put himself in a line like that and to put himself in a position where he said goodbye to a prospect that was quite healthy for him. You know, scientists, it's good money. That's a very brave thing to do.
It is. Emotionally, you do have to go to some very dark places. Well, your character has to go to some pretty dark places during the episode because of the color of his skin. Both, like you said, he's treated as an outsider, both in his community and at work, because of his choices. That can be an easy mental state to stay in as an actor for a prolonged period of time. But something that really struck me watching it is that is how many people of color experience life on a day-to-day basis, is that fear and pressure that you get from code switching and from being, you know, maybe the only one like you in the room. Talk to us a little bit about getting into that space and get also living in that space as just John.
Well, yeah, I mean, you definitely transfer some experiences, some feelings from your own personal day-to-day experience into the role. But the intensity of Leroy's time, the intensity of being one of the founding fathers of representation within the UK Met is different. And there's some traveling to do, as I like to call it. And emotionally, it's quite draining to see that he was always navigating such a space that wasn't welcoming. You know, before we're put into positions on set, you know, most of the other police officers would be in their big groups, you know, about five or six of them feeling like they had a sense of partnership with each other. And while the officers of color would be on the other side of the room just by themselves and quite isolated and not really supported. And to actually sit, live and breathe in those situations, you know, I don't know how Leroy done it, because if it was me, every scene you're seeing the AK. Every scene. But Leroy is just controlled and knows that there's a strategy, knows that there's a goal that he's working towards and keeps that as at the centerpiece of his decision making.
As much as we've been concentrating on the very dark periods of the film, there are light moments, and I want to get to some of the music in a minute, but one of them that is definitely a wink to the audience is there is, I don't want to spoil exactly what it is, but there is a Star Wars reference in the script. Was that in it before your participation, or was that added as a wink afterwards?
Nah, it was always in it. It was always in it. And I was like, is that, like, should I have whatever. It's cool. And then it just laid in. It just stayed in. But people liked it at the festivals. I was like, wow, okay, cool. Yeah, they like a little Star Wars reference over there. It's kind of cool.
You referenced, you know, looking for your project after filming the trilogy. Compare and contrast to me working on a, like, you know, massive blockbuster budget action film like those, and then getting to kind of do a quieter project like this one. Do you tackle that any differently as an actor? And what is that experience like for you? And were you looking for something that was very, very, very different when you were leaving the trilogy?
No, definitely. I think for me, I was just continuing what I've always wanted to do. I mean, I remember, I think it was between episode 8 and 9, I did Detroit. And I just wanted, I just like doing, I just like being the things I like to watch. And I like to watch all types of shit. So for me, it was a great opportunity to just step into versatility a bit, run in the opposite direction, and offer something different to the audience, you know, and at the same time, be a part of a story that I felt gave me the opportunity to film from home, you know, use my own accent-ish, you know, but use an accent that I'm quite used to, and just to feel that sense of artistry and work that you get from working with Steve McQueen.
This is a very timely piece, but it is a period piece. Mm-hmm. And your character loves Motown music, and we get some great moments of him enjoying music in the car and dancing and that kind of stuff. Were you a fan of music of that era? And if not, did you discover any music that you now have taken on to your daily life?
Yeah, Motown, definitely. I've actually been to Motown and been to the Escher Studios. They used to record while I was doing some press for Detroit in Detroit. And for me, I've always been a fan of that type of music. But to me, the surprising one was the UK jazz funk. I was like, wait, I didn't even know that was going down. I think in the scene where he's having a dance with Lenny, he's in the leather pants, and we had to learn a few of those dance moves. Let's just say it was a very liberating experience.
Because you are an advocate and you were active in the protests and really have been using your voice to make sure that progress is being made, how freeing is it to have a project that allows you to do that both in your art as well as in your promotion, you know, getting to talk about those subject matters now?
Yeah, it's mad, you know, to have that. Obviously now, if you do any kind of socially conscious project, people feel like, you know, maybe you met a director at the protest and that's why you got it. But what's great is that to know, obviously, that Red, White and Blue filmed prior, and to know that it's always been a passion of mine. But to see it reflect in reality, it is cool. It is cool. I guess it's also weird. It's also very, very strange. It's very strange to do that, because now you probably are looking at scenes, and we could look at scenes in scripts that we're looking at and being like, well, that kind of looks like, you know, it's too close to what's happening in reality. And it's like, cannot believe now that reality is that dramatic, you know? So it's an interesting sink, I say.
It certainly shows us how far we've come, but also how little change actually happened.
Right.
I think you all do a fantastic job of portraying the culture of your character's family and really giving a voice to their experience. What was it like to get to work on this project? Because there are often projects in which I'm sure you show up and you are one of the few people of color, both in front of and behind the camera. And in this project, that was not the case.
Yeah. It was great. It was great to know that and to network several people who know other individuals that I've worked with also in industry. And it was great to really just connect. But obviously what was important to me also was the conversation that it sparked off. I met a guy who, I think he was Grip, and he let me know about his experiences being in the Met in the 70s and how he worked at a station in London, and because of their innate racism and because he was kind of like titled as the local little snitch, you know, who just didn't like what they were doing, he left. And he was telling me how it was important being on set, seeing this kind of story conveyed. And I was there on set. It was actually when we'd done the reshoots in Wolverhampton. And I was just there shocked, like, mate, that's so crazy. And he goes, yeah, and now I'm working on this. Like, I'm seeing how the Bobby's dressed. Like, it's bringing him memories, but also there's a pain there of his experience of then having to leave that environment, an environment that he actually wanted to be a part of.
That's really powerful. And I'm so glad he got that experience and that you got to know the impact that this project is going to have on people. Speaking of that, what do you hope people take away from Red, White, and Blue?
I think it's just, it's such an education. I think, as I said before, it's a perspective that we don't have a lot of content on this. And it's just the expression of creativity coming from Steve McQueen is very special. You know, these were scenes that we fought hard to convey truth in these scenes. And if there wasn't any truth conveyed in it, we weren't gonna shoot it. You know, we had to get it before each and every given day. So I feel like the passion that reads off this project will definitely, you know, help guide people in the conversations that they need to have, the research that they need to do to see that these issues are still continuous, but to then be inspired by individuals like Leroy Logan, who has definitely a positive strategy in terms of just maneuvering and navigating such a negative space.
I can't emphasize enough how much people should check out Small Acts. It's 5 90-minute films, basically, each one very different, but thematically all linked by covering the same general themes. And John's is actually just one of the five. He's not in any of the other episodes, but they're all worth checking out. And that's available on Amazon Prime beginning December 4th, which is the same day that you can check out Riz Ahmed in the film Sound of Metal on Amazon Prime. So Amazon Prime, I guess this was your episode. We didn't plan it that way, but you can give us money if you want. Mara,
they're coming in hot from the holiday season.
Right? Mara, before we wrap things up, where can people find you on social media?
I am on Twitter at Mara E, M-A-R-A-H-E.
All right. And you can find me at Patrick Gomez LA. And that's going to do it for this Thanksgiving edition of Push the Envelope. We will be back next Thursday, as we always are, with new episodes. Until then, please remember to rate, comment, and subscribe. But that's going to do it for us for now. Until next week, bye.
Bye. Happy holidays.
Happy holidays. This episode of the AV Club's Push the Envelope was brought to you by producer Michaela Heck and sound engineer Ryan Allen.